HPPodCraft.com.
Alone in his attic chamber, Gaspar du Nord, student of alchemy and sorcery and quantum pupil of Nefer, sought repeatedly, but always in vain, to consult the viper-circled mirror. The glass remained obscure and cloudy, as with the risen fumes of satanical alembics or baleful necromantic braziers. Haggard and weary with long nights of watching, Gaspar knew that Nefer was even more vigilant than he.
Sorry, Andrew. That's actually pronounced necromantic braziers. Gaspar has seen a few of those in his time. He's our hero, and he's stepping up to the plate here in this second episode covering the Clark Ashton Smith. I'm calling it a masterpiece.
Yeah.
The Colossus of Elorn.
We're talking about it here on HP Podcraft, and I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We are engaged in strange studies of strange stories, and our reader is Andrew Lehman. Don't forget, the music from Dark Adventure Radio Theater by our pal Troy Sterling Niece is now available over at the HP Lovecraft Historical Society. I want to grab that. And we've been playing it in these episodes. Reaper Clark has scored a number of those as well. His stuff's on Bandcamp, so you can get that there. You can now get Troy's stuff at the Lovecraft Historical Society. You can't go wrong with it as a soundtrack for writing, gaming, lovecrafting, or lovemaking. We forgot to thank patrons in the last episode, I realized, so we'll take care of that at the end of this episode today. But I also wanted to thank some folks who suggested this specific story, which a few have. I looked up to see who. Eric Sroka wrote us back in 2016 to say, "Please stop writing me. I like Diane Wiest as well, but this is a terrible idea and will sue you if you try to use the title." I'm sorry, that's from Aaron Sorkin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was pitching a show to him where it's, you know, the actress Diane Wiest?
Of course I do.
I thought it would be really cool. You know, I just really love the way she raised those boys in The Lost Boys. And I thought that, wouldn't it be a great show if you took underprivileged kids and Diane Wiest taught them to raise pigeons? So she was raising them while they were learning to raise the pigeons. And it's called The Wiest Wing. That's what that was about. But he's fighting me on the title. Anyway. Sorry, the email's from Eric Sroka. I wanted to plug a couple of stories for the podcast. You and Chris seem a little lukewarm to Clark Ashton Smith. I guess we were. I would suggest The Beast of Averroine, The Enchantress of Silair, or one of my favorites, The Colossus of Elorn. Thank you, Eric, for that rec. And you know what? I think we'll look at some of those other stories for the rest of the month because we haven't chosen those. Matthew George wrote us as well in 2017. "Hey, fellows, I'd like to recommend The Colossus of Elorn by Clark Ashton Smith for the show. It's incredibly cinematic once you get past the exposition-rich first segment, and I'm a little surprised it's never been turned into a movie." Us too. We were just talking about it.
Red Mega Man wrote, this was back when we did the Seven Geishas, "I'd really like to hear you guys tackle another of Clark Ashton Smith's stories. I think there's a better chance you would like The Colossus of Elorn, which features a screwed up necromancer, a giant monster, and monks getting beaten to a pulp, several pulps. Another good one is The Empire of the Necromancers, which also features necromancers." Yep, and legions upon legions of undead.
Wow. I hope that there's a necromancer or two in Empire of the Necromancers. These are all great recommendations, so we're going to have to check those for length and see what we can do. But let's keep up with this Clark Ashton Smith Averroine stuff. I do remember we didn't like the Seven Geishas that much, so we must have been heating on him, and then people were writing these recommendations because of that.
I'm loving this.
Me too. And speaking of legions and legions of undead, that's pretty much the recap of this story as well. On the last episode, here's what happened. We had a bunch of dead people, healthy for being dead. They weren't diseased or old. They were young in the prime of life.
Dead people.
They jumped up out of their graves, made their way to this evil dwarf necromancer's hideout, where demons and wizard assistants are boiling all the bodies up in big flesh vats of some kind. Two wacky monks, they caught sight of all this, but they were tied up with innards and sent back home by demons, being beaten about the face, head, and chest area with their own crosses by the reanimated bodies of the town drunk and a maybe werewolf. That's the setup.
Oh my God.
That's not even what this story's about. Nope. That's just stuff you gotta know. As we get into the second episode of The Colossus of Elorn.
Now we're back to Wizard Gaspard.
He's a former pupil of Nether, the angry necromancer. It's mentioned in the story, but it's not really spelled out. But the people of this town, they've been super mean to Nether his whole life because of his short stature. So this is kind of a Hop Frog situation. We just don't get the injuries that were done to him. So since he's such a villain and people keep saying that, we assume he's just an evil guy. But I like to think that they really broke him, that there is some justification for what's about to happen.
Yeah, I think that he might not be as bad as everybody makes him out to be.
He is now.
I mean, we'll point out some stuff as we go along here.
It mentions even in the end, these people made fun of me, so that's what's going down. Yeah, thinking of that whole thing, though, it made me wonder, what would it be like if Edgar Allan Poe read this story? You know, if Clark Ashton Smith were able to go, Mr. Poe, I'm a big fan. This is kind of like Hop Frog. It's about a dwarf who gets revenge. You know, check it out. What would his reaction be?
Dude, I have no idea. What like, that stuff would blow his mind. Don't have things like this. Yeah. Yeah. Now, Gaspard is doing everything in his wizard power to figure out what is up with Nathair and what he is doing. He hears about what happened with the monks, and he knows that this is some serious stuff that's going on. But actually, this helps him because he knew Nathair was up to something, but he didn't know where he was doing his stuff, and now he's got a location.
Yes.
He also knew that the dwarf is dying, and he's going to be doing something huge on his way out, so some kind of vengeance thing, and he definitely has to stop this from happening.
Yeah, he's going to do something huge on his way out, and we're recording this episode in December, as you mentioned, but it's coming out the week before Inauguration Day here in the States, so I'm going to just go ahead and say this now. This is exactly like what Trump just did.
Wait, so you mean when Trump got a bunch of dead people's bodies, and then he transferred his essence into a giant Trump?
Or something equivalent, yes.
And attacked Washington, D.C.?
That's just happened at the airing of this episode.
Wow.
Isn't it weird how relevant the story is?
Yeah, man. Who knew?
Who knew?
Clark Ashton Smith was a prophet.
Yeah.
So the only way to find out what's going on with Nathair is to actually go to his hideout. But Gaspard, he's not rich. He has no horse. He doesn't even have a mule. But the situation is so dire that he is going to make this journey on foot.
You know, I always like it when there's economy in a story. And he's really poor, so he has to walk the whole way. He's got to pack a ham sandwich and just hoof it.
Well, he has only a dagger and a wallet of food.
Yes, I shouldn't have said sandwich because this is the 1200s. That wasn't invented yet. People actually kept all the ingredients for sandwiches. They just didn't. They kept it separated in a leather wallet, like you said. So they'd, they'd pull out each ingredient when they needed it. You know, 3 o'clock, I'm going to have some red onion. 3:30, you know, in the mayo section. Which sometimes it led to some pretty funny moments because you'd get the wallets mixed up, go to the store. Oh, no, I have the wrong wallet. Do you guys take bacon? That kind of thing would happen all the time.
It's a lame joke, and yet I'm laughing.
Of course you are.
He stays away from all the villages on his journey, and he just sleeps out in the woods. He's not afraid of the wolves or bandits or anything.
It says you're giving him too much or too little credit because it says he spent the warm summer night beneath a beech tree in the vicinity of a small village, not caring to sleep in the lonely woods where robbers and wolves and creatures of a more baleful repute were commonly supposed to dwell.
But he's outside of the village,
he's riding the line, man. He's on the edge.
On the second day, he gets to the castle ruins but waits until nightfall.
He wrote a poem while he was laying between the village and the woods. The line I ride.
Gaspard scales the craggy walls and he gets inside. He sees what the monks had seen previously. Big, huge, open space where there's all these chemical lab stations and there's big vats of stuff and fires and demons and wizards all just working on this big project.
No fire extinguishers, no eye wash stations, nothing like that.
He sees some broken stairs that he goes up along the outside of this immense chamber. There are these sooty figures moving around. The place is super busy. It's got, like I said, the fires in the cauldron, but then it has something else.
Gaspard had seen certain of the experiments and evocations of Nathair and was all too familiar with the appurtenances of the dark arts. Within certain limits, he was not squeamish. Nor was it likely that he would have been terrified overmuch by the shadowy, uncouth shapes of demons who toiled in the pit below him, side by side with the black-clad pupils of the sorcerer. But a cold horror clutched his heart when he saw the incredible, enormous thing that occupied the central floor. The colossal human skeleton, 100 feet in length, stretching for more than the extent of the old castle hall. The skeleton whose bony right foot the group of men and devils, to all appearance, were busily clothing with human flesh.
It's a giant zombie. Nathair is making a giant zombie, or for you D&D guys out there, a flesh golem.
Oh, well, hey, I think you can call it a flesh golem even if you're not a D&D guy, because that sounds pretty much like what it is.
Yeah, it's so rad. When the title of the story first fell upon my eyes, I thought it was going to be about maybe like a dude who's 10 feet, maybe 15 feet tall. This thing is 100 feet tall. That's some like Godzilla stuff going on there.
Well, it's funny you say that. I was, this is a little like Japanese Frankenstein, the kaiju Frank, you know, the Frankenstein conquers the world. Some of these movies.
Oh, right.
It's there. That adaptation of Frankenstein is like kaiju stuff. So he's actually a gigantic Frankenstein. So there's like films that have this kind of thing in there. I mean, it's an actor in a weird costume, but
sure.
Yeah, it reminded me of that.
Gaspard sees that there are batwing things flitting to and fro, taking materials to the sculptors of this thing. And this stuff is like clay, but Gaspard thinks it's made with blood, flesh, and fire. Mm-hmm. He looks around for Nathair, but he can't see him anywhere. And he wonders maybe Nathair is already succumbed to his disease and died, or maybe he's just too small to see from the vantage point that he's at. And as he's looking at this amazing monster mash, he is knocked out from behind.
Yeah, not too inventive. You know, what is this, Manimal? Somebody gets knocked out in Manimal before every commercial break, it seems like.
And that gets us to Chapter 5, The Horror of Yelorn. Gaspard comes to with Nathair staring at him.
One whole paragraph on Nathair's evil eyes. The writing of this thing is so great. You know, we're just doing plot here. It's just a meal, every paragraph of...
Yeah.
Adjective-laden descriptions of the stuff. It's so good.
Gaspard's hands are tied. He's in this disused alchemical lab. Nathair says, "Welcome." So Gaspard de Nord has come to see his former master. And that is some grade A villainy talk right there.
Imagine for a second how different this scene would be if that was Diane Weist, though. And like...
Gaspard de Nord has come to see his former master.
Oh my God, I'm getting
chills.
Is
that how she talks?
Yeah.
She kind of talks like that, yeah.
That is how she talks.
Bold as brass, Gaspard says that I am here to find out what you are up to, and that they're in stereotypical villain behavior, lays out the whole plot.
Yes, he does.
He's worked hard on it. He wants to share it.
And Gaspard will understand. It's so James Bond.
Well, of course he understands. He is a sorcerer as well.
Yeah.
So Nathair explains, by the grace of Satan, I love that, he will live on after his terminal illness, but not just in a normal short stature body. Oh, no. Satan goes big, literally. Nathair's mind and soul are going to be transferred into this giant body, 100 feet of evil necromancer.
Hey, just don't put this in the show because I don't want to sound stupid, but...
Okay, yeah, sure.
Can you do that? Is that like a burial option?
No, it's fiction.
Okay. Man, that's so crazy.
It sure is, man.
Yeah.
Nathair says, if you would have remained my apprentice, then you could have shared in this glory, but you are too squeamish.
Shared in this glory. We're going to find out what Nathair thinks of as glory for his assistants pretty soon. I think Gaspard made a good choice, personally.
He says, I would have used you for the bones, but it's too late. The Colossus is complete. But before I make the transfer, we're going to put you away, nice and tidy, in the dungeon. And making a classic evil villain mistake, Nathair doesn't kill the hero.
Nope.
To me, it sounds like he still has a little affection for Gaspard. He doesn't kill him right on the spot.
Yeah, we have to read into it. But he did used to be a student. So both he thinks he'll appreciate it. He feels bad that he wasn't there to join him in the creation of the Colossus. So there is some affection. And I think that's present. You know, a lot of stand-up comics do that bit. You've got James Bond right there. Don't put the spider on him. Just shoot him. I actually recently was watching some of those movies. All the villains have affection for James Bond. In fact, in Goldfinger, he puts Bond in a cell. Bond breaks out, and he's standing there with Pussy Galore, and he goes, "Didn't I put you in a cell?" Bond goes, "Yeah, I broke out." He's like, "All right." And they just hang out. He's not even like that mad about it. And it happens in Dr. No as well. He slips Bond a Mickey or something and knocks him out. And when Bond wakes up, he's like, "I've got this nice room for you and some clothes, and we're going to have dinner later." Everybody just really likes James Bond.
He's a cool guy.
It's not as preposterous as they make it out to be, is what I'm saying.
Gaspard is taken down, down, down into the dungeon. And he thinks, it's not so bad. But then they open up a hole in the floor and they throw him in that hole in the dungeon. So it's a hole in the deep dungeon. And he falls a long way, hits some shallow water, and he's stunned. The slabs replaced over the top, covering the hole. Things are not looking good for our hero.
Dude, this isn't Turn of the Screw. You can be explicit. It looks bad for our hero. You can just say it.
That gets us into Chapter 6, The Vaults of Yelorn. He gets his bearings. It's wet. It's dark. and there are snakes. They didn't bother to take his wallet of food or dagger off of him, so he has that on his side.
He peels off a few pieces of turkey. Oh, man, did somebody write a phone number on this turkey? Because in the 1200s, it's illegal to deface slices of turkey.
Phone number?
Yeah, you know how somebody will do that on a dollar bill now, yeah. In the present? Mm-hmm. In the, back then, when they had wallets for your food, that would happen then, too. He also says he has some potato chips in the change purse. He's really upset. He's like, I wish I'd broken this tomato when I was at the store earlier.
Stupid joke.
Sucks so much.
Oh. So he feels around. He can guess that this hole that he's in is 15 feet around, stone, kind of like a well. Yeah. And he's down there for a while. He doesn't know how long. It's just blackness. He catches a breeze of some kind, and that gives him a bit of hope. There might be some underground passage that he might be able to access.
Yeah, he didn't do anything to get out, though. It always makes me mad, you know. He demonstrated his action hero mastery by feeling a breeze. That's tough to do. Tom Cruise, he feels all his own breezes.
He's in the dark, but then the slab moves above him, and I'm thinking, oh no, things are going to get worse for him. But guess what? It's a basket with bread and wine, and it's lowered down to him. And I thought to myself, okay, this is kind of interesting, because Nathair doesn't want him to die.
No. And he wants him drunk. And we also learned that he doesn't want him to have a basket because the basket goes back up. So that's another character thing we learned.
When the lid is moved away, light comes in and Gaspard can see that the hole that the breeze is coming through, but it's pretty small and it looks like it was made for water drainage. Not great for escape. He drinks his wine, warms him up a bit. It gives Gaspard a little hope. And the walls are super old. And he thinks, you know, with this dagger, I could probably chip away at this wall and make this hole big enough for me to actually get through.
Just large enough for a pigeon, maybe.
Why? Why are you calling back to that?
Here's the thing, man. Uh-huh. I want to have a good year of shows.
Okay.
People really like our show. It's typically pretty good. So I thought, why don't I make some jokes that are so bad that it's just going to be all uphill from here, you know?
Yeah, okay, good.
In a good way.
So the stone crumbles underneath his dagger and things are looking up. He has to make the hole big enough for him to crawl through, and he does. He finally breaks through and there's another space. Again, it's pitch black, so he doesn't know if it's a room or what it is, but it's big enough for him to stand in. But this other space seems to be connected, and it's filled with water. The floor was a downwards incline, and the water deepened, rising to his knees and then to his waist. Probably the place once had been used as an underground exit for the castle, and the roof falling in had dammed the water. So he wades into the water, goes deeper and deeper until he finds that there's a passageway to his right, which leads to some stairs going up. He climbs higher and he starts to hear sounds, a crashing noise that reoccurs and it gets louder, the dim reverberant chanting of voices as in some satanic mass or liturgy with dirge-like cadences that turn to intolerably soaring paeans of evil triumph.
You know, it's funny because as he was making his escape from the dungeon, though, it's a little like when I was a kid, I would get a present and then I'd be grateful for the present for about 1 second and then I'd say, I wish I had like 10 of these. It's very similar here where I go, well, gosh, if he's going to escape, why didn't he fight like a snake man or something in the corridor?
Yeah.
You know, I wanted some extra. There are so many monsters in this story, yet still.
One of my criticisms, and there's very few of these, is there is no actual werewolf in this story.
No.
That would have been perfect right here.
Well,
there's a werewolf running around. He's got to fight the werewolf, use some of his trickery. That would have been great. So then he hears something that sounds like the beat of a giant heart. He reaches the top of the stairs and he sees all of this evil unholiness. The castle has been dismantled. It's got an open roof now.
Says that he goes, they must have used some kind of unholy magic to get the castle wall out of the way. Why bother doing that? Not in my movie. That Colossus is going to stand up and smash that wall. No behind the scenes magic removal. No.
Because it's night, he is able to figure out he was actually imprisoned for a day and a half inside the well, so it's not so bad. The Colossus is no longer a skeletal thing. It is fully fleshed.
Fearfully, as one who confronts an apparition reared up from nether hell, Gaspar beheld the Colossus that lay inert as if in cyclopean sleep on the castle flags. The thing was no longer a skeleton. The limbs were rounded into bossed enormous thews like the limbs of biblical giants. The flanks were like an insuperable wall. The deltoids of the mighty chest were broad as platform. The hands could have crushed the bodies of men like millstones. But the face of the stupendous monster, seen in profile athwart the pouring moon, was the face of the satanic dwarf Nathair, re-magnified 100 times, but the same in its implacable madness and malevolence.
We got thews.
You got thews in a giant head, you know. Normally that's Lovecraft's head and it's just floating outside of a window, yeah. But here we finally get it attached to a giant flesh gulp.
It's about time. Mm-hmm. The giant begins to breathe, its eyelids flutter, its fingers twitch. Gaspard sees the lifeless, small body of Nathair lying on the couch. The sorcerers chant to crescendo as the vapors swirl around and the giant moves, and that's it. Gaspard turns tail and just runs. Doesn't look back.
Into chapter 7, The Coming of the Colossus. Says Gaspard, fleeing headlong beneath the gibbous moon towards Vionne's, and fearing to hear the tread of colossal pursuer at any moment, had thought it more than useless to give warning in such towns and villages as lay upon his line of sight. So he's not, you know, get out of your houses, take cover. He's not bothering. If you don't run away when you hear these giant footsteps, that's your problem.
He's headed straight for Vionne's. But while he does that, oh my God. This chapter is just horrible things happening. Yeah. The first people that see this giant flesh thing are the monks, because remember, the monastery is on the opposite side of the valley. Right. The castle wall only comes up to his waist, and then fire erupts around it. The monks, they fall where they are, and they just pray. But that prayer was obviously met with thunderous demonic laughter.
When he drew nearer, bounding from slope to slope, his features were manifestly those of some great devil, animated with ire and malice toward the sons of Adam. His hair in matted locks streamed behind him like a mass of black pythons. His naked skin was livid and pale and cadaverous with the skin of the dead, but beneath it, the stupendous thews of a titan swelled and rippled. The eyes, wide and glaring, flamed like lidless cauldrons heated by the fires of the unplumbed pit.
I was really excited upon hearing that they made hair for him. Why did they do that? They didn't need to do that.
No. But it's huge hair. It's not like normal human hair and a bunch of it. It's like pythons.
They did it because it looks awesome. That's why they did it. They spent time giving him awesome hair.
Yes. There is an aesthetic that one aspires to.
Yeah.
As a necromancer. You know, you don't just slapdash these things, man. You are crafting undead art. The slightly recovered Bernard and Stefan are there. And they're the only ones that have the cojones to watch this thing moving out of the castle. But then it looks over at them and it sees the monastery and it gets kind of an evil smile on its face and it starts picking up rocks and throwing them at them. And these are like, it's being hit by a catapult. Like, these are huge rocks and it's wrecking the monastery. But then he's like, F that. And picks up a huge boulder and he throws it.
The tremendous mass broke in an entire side of the chapel, and those who had gathered therein were found later, crushed into bloody pulp amid the splinters of their carven Christ.
Dude, that is so metal.
In the movie, you know, there's going to be so much metal going on in this scene. Get it. And none of this polished, pretty metal stuff. It's going to be like how they played it back then in the 1200s, you know, gritty, like Sabbath.
Yeah, analog. All analog, yeah.
All analog, yeah, yeah, oh God, yeah.
It then wanders just kind of around the valley, stepping on shepherds and sheep. It roots up this huge tree and then uses it as a club, so now it's got a weapon?
Uh-huh.
Oh my God, it's so good. Next, it takes out this old temple that's there, just swings its club and smashes it into nothing. And then it starts going into the valley, destroying castles and villages. People try to protect themselves.
The lords of moated castles called in their men-at-arms, drew up their drawbridges, prepared as if for a siege of an army. The peasants hid themselves in caverns and cellars, hoping that he would pass them by unnoticed. The churches were crammed with refugees who sought protection of the cross, deeming that Satan himself or one of his chief lieutenants had risen to harry and lay waste the land.
People could see, this is the best, people could see on the giant's back that there's this huge basket and there's dudes dressed in black riding around in this huge basket that's on his back. It's the Thayer's apprentices riding along like Paris Hilton's chihuahua.
That's what it is. I couldn't think of what the comparison was. That's it. You nailed it.
He's got a little handbag full of necromancers.
Well, I was just kind of thinking when they made the basket, and they made the apparatus that they were going to go in, They're going, mm-hmm. man, this is going to be like a hot air balloon ride. This is going to be really fun. We're all going to be in the basket together. He's going to be wrecking stuff. We'll be safe up there. But then when he throws it on and he's walking with it, you know, they're hitting that back just over yeah. and over. It's not a fun ride. It's a little like when you go to the carnival and you go, that tilt-the-whirly kind of thing looks fun. The zipper, let's check it out.
Oh,
and then it
no,
feels like
not.
You're just in a centrifuge.
Makes you sick. Well, Nathair seems to be targeting certain individuals. It says there were people, mostly priests and women, it was told, whom he picked up as they fled and pulled them limb from limb as a child might quarter an insect. And there were worse things, not to be named in this record.
Oh, man.
What is worse than that?
I don't know.
Seriously, like, he's grabbing people, women, and ripping off their arms and legs. Like, I think that's pretty much as bad as it gets. I don't...
If there's something left unsaid here, it must be pretty bad because the descriptions... he's hunting yeah. people down. He's hunting hunters and killing horses, and there's bloody
oh,
watches
yeah.
and bashed bodies.
Is it sexual? Is that what that is about? Is that what... When every time they say unmentionable things after they just talk about somebody, you know, getting their arms ripped off, it's probably some... weird sex thing.
Yeah, or it's unmentionable just because it's sort of boring, you know, maybe he's it could be unmentionable. It's like, we're not going to get into it, but he sent a bunch of pizzas to this guy's house and it was just really annoying. I mean, he's doing stuff like that too.
It seems that Thayer is kind of waiting to go after Vjones. You know, he's building up to taking the city out. He wants to jack up the levels of fear to a maximum. You know, he's right. going around the city so that everybody knows he's coming eventually and they could see or hear about the heinous things that he's doing. As Gaspard gets to the gates, he looks a mess, crazed even. You know, he came out of a well. But the guard, yeah. they don't pay him any mind. They let him go because he's not the problem.
Right.
They know what's going on. They heard about this giant that's coming to destroy the city and kill everybody.
They're not going to knock him for his well-looking appearance. I mean, this is probably happening all over the city. People who aren't dressed in black tie are getting access to fancy parties. Folks without shirts or shoes are going into convenience stores. It's just chaos.
Gaspard gets back to his lab and he begins working on something to stop Nathair. Only sorcery can fight sorcery.
It's true. He had reasoned that the Colossus, being formed from the bones and flesh of dead men unlawfully raised up and energized only by the soul of a dead sorcerer, would be subject to the influence of this powder, which Nathair had used for the laying of resurrected liches. The powder, if cast in the nostrils of such cadavers, would cause them to return peacefully to their tombs and lie down in a renewed slumber of death. That surprised me. I thought it would cause them to, like, you know, decompose spontaneously or something.
Yeah, I kind of like this. It's yeah. sort of strange. It's nothing you would expect to happen, and it kind of is a neat twist for me.
Yeah.
He has to make this huge batch because, obviously, it's a giant zombie and a regular batch for a regular-sized zombie, so he's got to, you know, times 100 or however big this thing is. Just as he finishes, it's morning, and he senses that Nathair is coming, not out of any preternatural sense, but there's people screaming in the distance and big booming footsteps, you know, all that stuff. So Gaspard knew that he had to get himself up high so that he can throw this powder into the face of Nathair. The walls at the city are not high enough, but the great cathedral, that's the only thing that can get him up to the height that he needs to be. So he fills the satchel and he gets onto the street. There's so many people running, headed towards the cathedral because, you know, what else are they going to do? Hopefully God will save them from this. It says he let himself be borne along by the frenzy-driven stream of people.
Yeah.
The cathedral is now rampacked with folks. Gaspard finds stairs that are able to take him up to the gargoyle warded roof.
That's pretty cool, so though. Good. He sort of crowd surfed his way up there, you know?
Yeah.
It's gonna be awesome for the movie.
He hides behind a statue and watches Nathair move towards the city. The city, they shoot boulders at him. They don't affect the giant at all. All the arrows are stuck in his flesh, but he doesn't even bother to pull them out. Footmen are battered away by his tree club, and he's just laughing the whole time. So he moves through the city, knocking houses over willy-nilly, moving closer to the cathedral, and as he gets there, he yells out,
"Ho, priests and devotees of a powerless god, come forth and bow to Nathair the Master before he sweeps you into limbo."
At this point, Gaspard steps out, and he yells for Nathair to come close so that they might speak.
"Is it you, Gaspard, my recreant pupil?" the Colossus roared stormily. "I thought you were rotting in the oubliette beneath Ilorn, and now I find you perched atop this accursed cathedral, which I am about to demolish! You had been far wiser to remain where I left you, my good Gaspard."
Yeah.
He still has respect for him.
he does. Nathair has his hand above Gaspard, as if he's going to move to grab him. But as he does this, Gaspard throws his powder into his face, and for a moment, nothing happens. But then Nathair's angry face goes blank, like he just kind of relaxes. And he drops his giant club, and then he just wanders out of the city, back the way he came. Said he muttered dreamily to himself as he went, and people who heard him swore the voices were no longer the awful, thunder-swollen voice of Nathair, but the tones and accents of a multitude of men, amid which the voices of certain of the ravished dead were recognizable. And the voice of Nathair himself, no louder now than in life, was heard at intervals through the manifold mutterings as if protesting angrily. It wandered around the land for many hours, searching for tombs and graves of the various corpses it's made from, but there are no graves that are big enough for this colossus to lie down in.
I thought maybe all the bodies were just going to peel away and strip off of it.
I thought so too, yeah.
Like droplets of flesh, but it actually is looking for to put itself down. Hole.
Then, towards evening, men saw it from afar on the red rim of the sky, digging with its hands in the soft, loamy plain beside the river Iswal. There, in a monstrous and self-made grave, the colossus laid itself down and did not rise again. The 10 pupils of Nathair, it was believed, unable to descend from their basket, were crushed beneath the mighty body, for none of them was ever seen thereafter. For many days, no one dared to approach the place where the corpse lay uncovered in its self-dug grave. And so the thing rotted prodigiously beneath the summer sun, breeding a mighty stench that wrought pestilence in that portion of Averon. And they who ventured to go near in the following autumn, when the stench had lessened greatly, swore that the voice of Nathair, still protesting angrily, was heard by them to issue from the enormous, rook-haunted bulk. Of Gaspar du Nord, who had been the savior of the province, it was related that he lived in much honor to a ripe age, being the one sorcerer of that region who at no time incurred the disapprobation of the church.
Yeah, he could probably get up to whatever he wanted and the church would be okay with it.
Dude, yes.
That's the end of the story. I love it. Oh. That was great. Thank you, everybody, for recommending that one because I just had a great time.
That is just what the doctor ordered. Thank you so much.
We're going to pick one of these other Clark Ashton Smith medieval French monster-y stories to do next week. We'll have to look at them and see which one we want, but this one's been great. I want to thank Andrew Lehman for reading on both of these. Don't forget to go over to the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society and pick up their Dark Adventure Radio Theater soundtrack by Troy Sterling Neese. It's great stuff. You've been hearing it throughout. I also want to thank some patrons.
I'd like to thank Shane Lanigan.
I'd like to thank Michael Seary.
I'd like to thank Carol McOlge.
Connor Fitzpatrick, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Neil DeCarteret.
I'd like to thank Justin Woodman. Hey,
Justin, yeah. I'd like to thank Robert Daniel Picard.
I'd like to thank Jacob Wheel.
I'd like to thank Brittany Elmer.
And finally, I'd like to thank Jacob. That's Jacob with a K. You guys are great. We're going to keep trucking on this. For now, that's all we got. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to HP Podcraft.
Strange Studies, Strange Stories.
HPPodcraft.com.